Chicago, Detroit, L.A., Miami, Orlando, Durham, Kansas City, St. Louis, New Orleans. Workers descended on McDonald's headquarters and franchises across the country this week in protest of sexual harassment complaints brought by employees. In the hundreds of voices, here's one of them.
My name is Kimberly Lawson. I'm 25 years old. I have a 3-year-old daughter. I work at the McDonald's on Main Street in Kansas City, Missouri, and I make $8.75 an hour.
Kimberly got the job last June, but then she started having trouble with both a shift manager and a coworker.
There were two different incidents. One was from a shift manager, and he basically made really lewd comments towards me and constantly flirted and made advances towards me, and I, you know, tried to decline him as politely as possible because he was a shift manager. And eventually I just cut my shift down an hour so I wouldn't have to encounter him again. The second incident was with a coworker. He would flirt with me as well. Then it started from flirting to trying to give me gifts and stuff like that. And then eventually it escalated into him brushing up against me and touching my butt and stuff.
So Kimberly tried to do something about it.
I talked to a shift manager, and I actually talked to the GM, and the shift manager actually, you know, just told him to stay away from me and leave me alone and, you know, just to stay out of my space. And the GM, he just brushed it off and just told me that I don't have to worry about it because he was going to get himself fired pretty soon anyway, but he's still there.
Kimberly told us that she felt like she didn't get the support from her employer that she needed, and she wasn't protected from these types of incidents happening in the first place.
I felt like that there should be some type of training, or they should know that their own rules, and the fact that he didn't care and he still made his advances, and even though I showed that they were unwanted, I felt like I was more expendable than he was because he was a manager and I was just a crew member.
And the last year has been a difficult time for Kimberly.
I felt very violated. I felt like it wasn't a safe place to be. I felt like it could happen again and, you know, it might happen again. I felt like I couldn't quit because I need my income, because I do have a daughter to take care of. And I just felt like I was just in a very bad place because I was in a work, I am in a work environment that I still feel uncomfortable in, and I still feel like they don't take the safety of their employees very seriously.
Today, low-wage workers and the Me Too movement. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
We all stand up for ourselves because we do matter, and we are not just expendable employees. That if this keeps happening, if we keep allowing it to happen, then maybe it will escalate if we don't stop it now.
You just heard Kimberly Lawson's story. Groping, propositions for sex, lewd comments by supervisors. Those are just some of the allegations workers are bringing against McDonald's this week. Two national advocacy groups, the Fight for 15 and the Time's Up Legal Defense Fund, brought the claims on behalf of 10 current and former employees of the fast food chain. Both McDonald's Corporation and individual franchises were named to the complaint. And in response, McDonald's spokeswoman Terry Hickey told us on Monday there is, quote, no place for harassment and discrimination of any kind. Except that's not the reality for many women who work in low-wage service sector jobs. According to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, between 2005 and 2015, the accommodation and food services industry had the highest number of sexual harassment charges filed by women. That was followed by retail trade, domestic work, healthcare, social assistance, manufacturing, and office administration. Fatima Goss-Graves is president and CEO of the National Women's Law Center, which houses and runs the Time's Up Legal Defense Fund. Time's Up is providing funding for these 10 women's cases, and her organization has been tracking the data on complaints brought by low-income workers closely. Fatima, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So a lot to unpack here. Let's start with addressing this specific case being brought against McDonald's. This isn't the first time that workers have brought these types of complaints. 2 years ago, there were similar allegations made. What did women allege at the time, and how far have we come today?
So in 2016, very similar allegations were made against McDonald's and many of its franchisees, that women were enduring verbal harassment, lewd comments day in and day out, sexual touching, and that when they reported, they saw one of two outcomes. Either nothing happened, or they experienced retaliation for coming forward. So they filed these charges with the EEOC, and I think it's a good example of what happens, especially in low-wage jobs, and that it is, in general, hard to get attorneys to take these types of cases. And a large employer can really just wait it out and not make the sort of changes that would make a meaningful difference throughout their workforce.
I would like to address the fact that you said it's hard for an attorney to take these cases. Why is that?
Well, for, you know, litigation is expensive for sure, and that's true whether or not you make a lot of money or you are a low-paid worker. And unfortunately, the amount you can get in recovery and the amount the attorney could ultimately get definitely varies if you are a low-wage worker. It's going to be much smaller. And so one of the things that we wanted to be sure happened with the Time's Up Legal Defense Fund is that we created the right incentives to be sure that more attorneys were stepping in and taking cases, especially in low-wage fields where rates of harassment are high.
And is that because attorneys, I mean, essentially aren't going to make enough money off of the client if it's a low-wage worker?
That's right. I mean, if you think about it, this, many attorneys are basically small businesses themselves, right? And they can only do so much pro bono and so much reduced rate type cases. And drawing attorneys into cases where they may not be able to recover all of the money that they put into it, and it is more difficult to do. So we have been able to draw more attorneys in to be willing to sign up to the Time's Up Legal Defense Fund. And for some cases, we will be able to also financially support them to help defray the costs.
Now, we talked about the previous charges against McDonald's for similar behavior. What's different about the charges like Kimberly's that are being brought this time?
Well, it really importantly, the charges in many ways are similar, involving individuals who have experienced harassment, comments, unfortunate touching, some of which they've reported and experienced retaliation. So if you looked in 2016, you'd say, oh, that's terrible conduct. And if you look at the charges now, you would be pretty appalled. One of the key differences is that we were able to draw in and support really experienced attorneys to help to bring these cases who are committed to bringing and staying with these women. And we really believe that that will help to make a difference. They're not going to just be able to wait these charges out.
Curious about whether, I mean, we saw the Me Too movement launch and really in its has been centered around white collar employees and Hollywood movie stars. Are these cases of low wage women workers not getting the attention they deserve?
I think we have an opportunity to make the Me Too movement what we believe it should be. And that is a movement that ensures that all women, no matter where they work, can work with safety and dignity. And so that is what we are trying to do here, to ensure that Me Too and this public conversation touches everyone, every aspect of their lives. And you know, people who are working in low-wage jobs, it's, you know, these aren't the sexiest jobs. They aren't the most exciting things. So it is harder to get the same level of attention. But we know their stories are powerful. We hear from them every single day at the Time's Up Legal Defense Fund. And so we are really thrilled to be able to shine a light on what they are facing at work and try to push businesses to do better by these workers too.
Are low-wage workers more susceptible to certain types of harassment than, say, white-collar workers might be?
you know, one of the things that we know is that harassment is an everywhere problem in every single field. But for low-wage workers in particular, there's some job conditions that make it especially hard. Some of it is the low pay, right? So you make low wages, you don't have a savings, and when you're faced with enduring harassment or standing up and potentially losing your job to retaliation, many people take it day in and day out because they can't afford to lose a day's paycheck, and that's a reality. The other thing that we know in fast food in particular, you have a lot of young workers. For many women, this is their first job. They're 15, 16, 17 years old, including some of the people who have filed charges. And, you know, they experience this harassment and have no idea where to go, nowhere to turn to. And when they have come forward, they too experience retaliation, which is an especially hard way to enter the workforce.
And I would also say that the fast food profile, worker profile has changed in addition. It's also people who are heads of household, single moms in many instances. I'm curious about, we just had a decision from the Supreme Court around the issue of an employee's ability to bring a class action suit against his or her employee. What role would that play in an employee's ability to bring these types of sexual harassment cases?
You know, just this week, the Epic Systems case was a pretty devastating case because it basically said that employers could require their workers to sign these documents that basically say any complaints that you have, including of discrimination, have to be dealt with through arbitration and individually. And what that will ultimately mean is that for most workers, they'll be forced into what is kind of a secret process to deal with these very serious claims, and they lose the ability to stand together with other people and challenge as a class or as a collective action. So that's really devastating. I think what we can expect, unfortunately, to see is that more and more employers, now that this has been sanctioned by the Supreme Court, will come up with these sorts of arbitration agreements, these forced arbitration agreements, and that don't allow you to actually engage collectively or as a class.
Fatima Goss-Graves is the president and CEO of the National Women's Law Center. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Hey, podcast listeners. This is Irva Gunja. I'm the executive producer of The Takeaway. And all this week, we've been hearing from folks about the gun talk. For different people, that'll mean different things. It might mean for you, you're talking to your kids about school safety and the mass shootings. In other families, it might mean you're talking about gun safety. And maybe in your family, you're not talking about it at all. Either way, we want to hear from you. What's the gun talk in your family, if you're having one at all? Call us, 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can also leave us a voice memo by going to thetakeaway.org/mytake. Or go on Twitter. You can see the hashtag MyGunTalk. You'll find out what other people are saying using that hashtag, and you can add your story there too. Thanks.
To kneel or not to kneel, or to fine the team that does. Well, the NFL will have a new policy on this controversial issue. The league will require players on the field to show the anthem and the flag, quote, appropriate respect, and teams, not individual players, can be fined for not adhering. The league will allow players, however, to stay in the locker room for the anthem. Albert Breer, a writer for Monday Morning Quarterback, first broke the news. And a reminder, players are kneeling to protest police brutality and racial inequality. Dave Zirin is a sports writer for The Nation magazine and the host of the Edge of Sports podcast, and he's here to break down this new policy.
That means that 24 of the 32 NFL ownership representatives voted to change what they call the operations manual of the league, which will require players to either stand for the anthem or remain in the locker room. So what they're trying to do is actually erase the players who are using the anthem space to protest police violence and racial inequity.
Now, isn't that a type of suppression, Dave? I mean, I feel like there's something really odd happening here. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, no, what's happening here is a form of suppression. They're trying to silence players' voices. And the reason why they may not get away with it is not only there are constitutional questions about whether players have the right to protest during the anthem, during that space, but there's also the question about the collective bargaining agreement where it is enshrined with the union that players do have the right to protest during the anthem. I mean, keep in mind, players have only been coming out for the anthem for slightly less than a decade. And it doesn't come out of respect for the anthem or 9/11, but it comes out of a financial partnership with the Pentagon, as uncovered by John McCain and Jeff Flake, the two senators from Arizona. So this is a kind of ridiculous exercise that the NFL is doing this for a couple of reasons. The first is because they actually do, what we know this from their behind-the-scenes meetings, they have a fear of Donald Trump, someone who they've given millions of dollars to, and the idea that he'll continue to use the NFL as a punching bag and use the NFL, the pulpit to say that the NFL is not a patriotic operation.
Or are they not? Or are they not as fearful of the players just getting fed up and moving on? Is that where the fear scale lands?
Yeah, the other fear is that they're losing control of labor. That they're losing control of being able to tell the players what to do and having the players do it. I think that Colin Kaepernick and the other players that have organized themselves during the anthem to raise these issues have represented the greatest threat to ownership, institutional control of players that we've seen since free agency, which was 25 years ago. And I think that scares them. And so this is a way of, in the words of one owner who's a bit against this policy, muzzling is how he put it, which is an interesting word since it is connected usually to animals. But he said that he was worried about this policy muzzling players and keeping them silent and how that would look.
Now, what's the likelihood that this could actually result in a backlash, Dave, by players who say, you know what, we're not doing this, or by folks who are agreeing with it and saying, you know, fans maybe who agree with this?
Well, I mean, first of all, about fans, like, are we a step away from fining fans who don't stand for the anthem or go to the bathroom during the anthem or don't take their hats off during the anthem or belch during the anthem? Because anyone who's been to the NFL game knows that it's hardly graduation day at the Naval Academy when the anthem plays. But to get to your question, I think that we could be looking at a significant backlash among a core of NFL players because what they don't like is being told what to do. They want this to be collectively bargained through the union. And even though the owners say that they don't have to do it through the union, the players would say very differently.
Dave Zirin is a sports writer for The Nation magazine and host of the Edge of Sports podcast and is always so helpful coming on to talk to us about these issues. Thanks, Dave.
Thank you so much.
On this vote, the yeas are 258, the nays are 159. The bill is passed, and without objection, the motion reconsider is laid on the table.
10 years after the financial crisis and subsequent global recession, the House of Representatives passed a bill yesterday that would roll back the Dodd-Frank banking regulations. The measure would leave in place some Dodd-Frank rules, but would exempt some small and regional banks from some of the strictest regulations, including a yearly stress test where banks must demonstrate that they can handle another economic disaster like the one we saw in 2008. The Senate already approved the bill in March, and we should say, in both the House and the Senate, this was a bipartisan effort. And it's now set for President Trump's signature. Joining us now, Erica Werner, congressional reporter for The Washington Post, is with us. Erica, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So for those of us who have probably put out of our minds the 2008 banking crisis, remind us what Dodd-Frank was intended to do.
Right. There was a huge worldwide financial crisis. The U.S. economy was on the verge of collapse. In the wake of that, the Dodd-Frank legislation was passed essentially to try to avoid a repeat of that situation by placing a number of regulations on banks across the country, one of the most notable being, as you referenced, any bank with over $50 billion in assets would have to undergo a yearly stress test, which was designed to prove that they could withstand any repeat of that crisis. So that legislation was passed by a then Democratic-controlled Congress and signed by President Obama. Was opposed all along by Republicans who, once they retook control of Congress, have aimed to repeal it.
So is this a win for small banks? Is it a win for average Americans? Or is it a win for Wall Street?
It depends on who you ask. The driving force behind passing this legislation was the banking lobby, particularly the community and regional banks that can be found in every congressional district in America, and that often local branches are familiar to voters and are kind of friendly presences in local communities, perhaps particularly in more rural states and areas. So those banks are a very effective lobby. So the heart of the legislation exempts banks that have between $50 billion and $250 billion of assets from these yearly stress tests. So those in particular are the big winners. But there's also an expectation among critics of the legislation in particular that the very biggest banks could end up benefiting as well, and that there could be consolidation in the industry where some of the smaller banks feel like they can combine and get bigger because they would then be in a category that would not be subject to these strictest federal regulations.
This doesn't sound like average everyday Americans who use banking services are really getting anything out of this. Am I wrong on that?
There again, it depends who you ask. The proponents of the legislation, particularly the Democrats in the Senate who were pushing for it, argued that these community banks, because they were subject to strict federal regulations, had to pull back from community lending, community banking. They were not able to issue as many mortgages, issue as many loans to average Americans because of these regulations. However, critics of the legislation dispute that and say that this legislation, this what will become law because President Trump is going to sign it in coming days, could put the U.S. financial system at greater risk of another crisis like the one we saw 10 years ago. And it kind of, in all cases, essentially loosens up regulations on these banks and on what they're able to do. So it's possible that as a consumer, you could see something that's a benefit or that could at least feel like a benefit in that it becomes perhaps easier to get a mortgage. But it's also possible, at least according to critics and also according to an independent analysis by the Congressional Budget Office, that the bill injects more risk into the system overall.
Lots to think about. Erica Werner is a congressional reporter for The Washington Post. Erica, thank you for your insights.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If you like what you're hearing, give us a rating and review us on iTunes. It helps us in ways you can't imagine. Also, tell your friends. Share this podcast on Facebook or Twitter or wherever you want your followers to get some solid news coverage. They'll be smarter and they'll think you're a hero. It's a win-win. All right, now back to the show.
That's the sound of over 4,000 dogs at a Ridgeland Farms facility in Wisconsin. The company name evokes green pastures, but it's actually one of the three largest organizations in the United States that breeds beagles for purposes of experimentation, after which the dogs are often killed. In 2016 alone, a reported 800,000 animals were used for testing in science and commercial purposes. Journalist Glenn Greenwald, who you might know from The Intercept, runs the Hope Dog Shelter in Rio de Janeiro, and he has 24 rescue dogs himself. And he's been reporting on the testing of dogs for commercial purposes.
So a lot of people don't even know that there is legalized medical experimentation and product experimentation on dogs in the U.S. at all, let alone how horrific it is. And so when we began doing our investigation, I mean, even I, as somebody who has done a lot of reporting on abuse of animals, was pretty shocked by what I discovered, because it's actually quite a large industry. In 2016 alone, just in terms of what's reported, there were 60,000 dogs used for various forms of experimentation. The legal standards that govern how they have to be treated are extremely lax and permissive. And in maybe the majority of cases, but certainly a substantial number, those standards are violated. And when they are, the Agricultural Department is extremely lenient on the violators, barely even fining them any amount of money that would change their behavior. And these dogs are essentially bred into life for no purpose other than to be used in excruciating and torturous experiments and then killed once they're done, once their use is complete.
And I'll admit, I was one of these people who had no idea that this was happening in the United States. What kind of dogs are we talking about, and what types of experiments are they used for?
So there's this gruesome irony that the preferred breed of dog for experimentation is the Beagle, because it's one of the breeds that has been bred to be most loyal, most trusting, most docile with humans. They have an incredible desire for human companionship, and so they never are aggressive with humans. No matter how much you hurt them or abuse them, they keep trying to regain your trust, and so they're very easy to manipulate by lab workers. But they've also used homeless dogs, picked up dogs from shelters for free, and used them for experiments. There are companies that do that as well, and the experiments run from drilling holes in their head and injecting their brains with various viruses to force feeding them commercial products like laundry detergents and other poisons, to injecting their bodies with pathogens in order to follow the route of the disease. And so it ranges from medical experimentation to testing for commercial purposes. And the saddest part of it all is that it very rarely produces anything of value, because the physiology of dogs is so different than that of humans that even the tests that are justified by medical necessity often have almost no value.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Glenn Greenwald, and we're talking about the dog testing industry in the United States. What does the dog testing industry tell us about our relationship as Americans with dogs? I mean, it seems to be the quintessential American pet. We have entire industries around loving our dogs and caring for our dogs, and yet this is happening.
Well, that's exactly right. They play a really important role in our lives. They become members of our family. They've been known forever as man's best friend. They've been essentially bred to live with great love and compassion with humans. And that's why this industry depends upon remaining hidden. And they've gone to great lengths to hide themselves. They prosecute the animal rights activists who film what happens inside of their facilities with extreme aggression. They often accuse them of being terrorists or felony charges that can send them to prison forever. There's a lot of money behind this industry and a lot of effort designed to keep it hidden, because that's the only way they can continue to do it.
Glenn, why did you decide to focus on the dog testing industry now? What about other animals, as we know, that are also used in medical testing?
Well, for one thing, I've done a lot of reporting over the last year and a half or so on industrial farms and the mass torture and slaughter of animals like pigs and turkeys and the like. And I think the reason why this is starting to resonate more, it was once the case that animal rights was kind of thought of as this fringe left-wing issue. But it's really become a lot more popular across the political spectrum. You see Republican members of Congress introducing laws to curb abuse and testing of animals. And I think dogs are sort of the gateway, if you will, into animal rights, because people come to understand that animals are living beings who have high levels of emotional complexity and intelligence and who suffer and feel pain, and can then translate that into their empathy for other animals who we also impose incredible suffering on. So there's some bills pending to prevent taxpayer-funded experimentation on dogs and the like, and it just seemed like the right moment, in addition to the fact that some activists recently went to Ridgeland Farms, which is a big Wisconsin dog breeder that provides dogs for experimentation, and documented with horrific film how they're treated while they wait to be sold. And so we got a hold of that film and were able to use it to do the reporting.
Now, of course, we have an upcoming farm bill in the United States, and I'd love if you could talk to us a little bit about what you're expecting to see in that as it pertains to animal testing.
Well, it's really interesting because, as I alluded to earlier, there is this kind of transpartisan or trans-ideological acceptance of the need to curb abuses of animals. And there's a group in particular called the White Coats Project that has been formed that is focused exclusively on ending taxpayer-funded testing of animals in order to attract people on the left who tend to prioritize animal rights, and then people on the right who tend to prioritize abuse of government funds. And a lot of these right-wing members of Congress who are actually animal rights activists can justify what it is they're doing by saying that it's being done to save wasteful government expenditures. And it's uniting people across the spectrum. And so there's a good chance that this new bill could contain some added protections, but there's also a chance, because of how powerful the agricultural lobby is, especially among the Republicans who control Congress, that it could actually weaken some of the already weakened regulatory framework. And so that's a big part of why we're doing the reporting now, is because that fight really is ongoing within Capitol Hill between lobbyists and people who are kind of true believers in the cause.
Glenn Greenwald is the co-founder of The Intercept, and he also runs the Hope Dog Shelter in Rio. He currently has 24 rescue dogs. Glenn, thanks so much for being with us.
Really, thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.
Join the conversation on The Takeaway's Facebook page or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for talking with me today. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.